Margaret Thatcher is a visionary. Who on earth actually agrees with David Lammy? I would have thought probably nobody in Scotland, which may speak volumes really about where Labour is trying to aim in deifying a woman who basically destroyed the British economy and much of our society. So we take a little dilly through that. We look also at Mark Blyth's comments at Scotonomics at the weekend that have now been turned around by many of the unionist press. What was he really saying, that independence is completely impossible and likely to be worse than Brexit and its results? We take a good look at everything he said and come to slightly different conclusions. We also discuss the WASP women, the vote in the UN Security Council to force Israel into an immediate ceasefire and release of all the hostages. Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, Johns, and welcome to this week's Leslie and Riddick podcast. And, you know, a philosophical reflection to actually commence with. I notice as the light is coming through the window, shining for the first time, you know, probably in weeks and weeks and weeks after the winter that we've had, that what that light does is it points out just how mucky every single surface in the house is. And you're thinking, I thought this was clean. No, it's covered in dust and there's bits of stuff I've seen and chips off paint and stuff like that. So hopefully, just thinking about that, that this week's podcast might actually be that little ray of sunshine that peeks through your windows and sheds light on the dusty entrails of what's been going on.
Or not.
Or not, yeah. Well, that's the thing, is that, yeah.
We were just saying before we start that every week just seems like there's just such huge, big, thumping issues sitting there. And it feels a bit like sort of just diving in blindly into the deep end, basically, you know, to just, you've got to get going somewhere, haven't you? Yeah. And probably, I can hear it now a bit more, but just to say, Pat's in a different room because there's roadworks happening outside his house. So if any of you are sort of thinking, oh, it's going to be a bit echoey, that's the only reason why. And he's also, because he won't mention it himself, he is manfully kind of dealing with a very sore sort of gum problem thing.
Yeah.
That's all the background today, which and I'm fine.
Yeah, which I refer to when I sent it to Leslie, which is, I don't know what pains me more, the abscess or the price I'm going to have to pay to have the dental work done. But either way, you know, it's the, oh God, yes, that's a bit political choice, isn't it? Oh, anyway, however, yes, he takes a deep breath and diving in to the conflicted world of, and it's been fought on social media just now, which is all sorts of, I think, inflammatory statements flying around from my perspective about the, and I'll just call it the Hate Crime Act. I won't give it the full title, the Hate Crime Act, which is going to be enacted on April the 1st. And before we embark on it, what idiot thought that Gout's Day was a great idea to launch anything, you know, any kind of act, let alone one that was going to attract the attention that it definitely attracted. So we leap into that because, you know, it's, you know, I've got perspectives on it, but I'll go for it
because honestly, I kind of keep swinging with many of these things.
Yeah.
You know, because on the one hand, well, as soon as you get Murdo Fraser kind of whining about something, you're tending to kind of, you know, the opposite point of view. Joanna Cherry's come out sort of supporting Murdo, actually. Murdo Fraser objected because there was, he basically said something really childish, actually, in a tweet. And it was not seen as a hate crime, but it was logged as a kind of hate incident.
Yes. Because
if you're going to have monitoring, you need to kind of have numbers. And so the fact that this had popped up became a number. He unusually found out about it and was, you know, aghast. And of course, the background to the whole hate crime bill thing is that people kind of feel that they will be stopped from saying anything critical about anybody. And whilst there's been some very good articles, we've mentioned them before, Andrew Tickell wrote a very good article sort of saying this is really just tidying up a lot of previous legislation and just broadening out the categories of people that you can essentially aggravate offences by, you know, so that it's not just race now, it broadens out. I mean, that's true. It's also true that if people who haven't got time to sit and read the detail of an act, it very possibly will feel there's just a general kind of, I can't remember what the euphemism is, but a sort of deadening feeling around there generally, in that the more that you get stories like this, the more it just becomes an urban myth that you can't say a thing without somebody coming and whacking you out of the back of the head. There's also the point in this that Murdo Fraser raised, that, you know, however much police time has had to be spent on logging or otherwise, whatever, I can't even remember what he said. It was about identifying, and, you know, it's just, it's the same as identifying as a cat, you know, trans, juvenile. Which is kind of pathetic. But I mean, you know, if there's going to be somebody creating mischief, can just keep reporting this kind of stuff, and the police are honour bound to put that as a top priority, because it is a priority at the moment. Mm-hmm. So it does raise some questions as quite how you're using time. I mean, this whole parts of Scotland, we're in one of them, where there's a policy now of not responding to sort of small mm-hmm. crimes. You know, there was that, I was included in that when somebody stoved a window in last year. So, you know, of course, everybody will always look at it that way and will go, hang on a minute, you know, where's my response? And you're going to spend time one worrying about Murdo Fraser. So it's kind of, I don't really know myself now which way I would go on this. But what's your thoughts, my dear?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm exactly the same position, because I read the Andrew Dickell article, which I thought was absolutely excellent. And then I read Joanna Cherry's article, which I thought was absolutely excellent as well. And these are two grown-up people, if I can put it that way, talking in a grown-up way about it. And it's, as I say, it's not throwing juvenilia around, because one of the key aspects that Andrew talked about and Joanna talked about was the fact of the dealing with frivolous, targeted complaints being made to the police that was going to take up police time. We're actually creating that atmosphere around, creating an atmosphere if it continually being reported that, say, someone is gender critical, and that's been perceived by the individual reporting it as being a hate crime, and it may not be defined as such, again, looking at the act and the defences that are available. But it does seem to me that at that point you're dealing with two reasonable people, and hopefully we're two reasonable people. But in the real world, particularly when it comes to social media, it can be identified with precisely what Murdo Fraser tweeted, which was juvenile and was unreasonable. You know, to actually comment about a non-binary person is the same as identifying a cat. It's ludicrous. It's not a crime, but it's silly. And that's the aspect that gets to me there. The other element of it that did worry me about is the deliberate omission of sex from it, because it's got in it prejudices, age, disability, religion, sexual orientation, transgender identity. And these are aggravating factors. And for people complaining about this, aggravators have been there in all sorts of legislation for decades. But the exclusion of the sex one was, and then Joanna talks particularly about this, but I did look at it, and Helena Kennedy KC was part of the group that put together proposals for a specific act, a bill to be presented before the Scottish Parliament, which is going to deal specifically with misogyny. And I took a look at that act, and it is incredibly detailed. And I'll put a link up to it. Incredibly detailed in the way it tackles this. And it's very, very specific and very strong. The difficulty is that, given parliamentary time, that won't be on the statute books, because I presume it will be passed, until June 2025, I think, about the earliest. And it was deliberately excluded, as Helena Kennedy said, because misogyny was so inbuilt into the patriarchal society that it deserved a separate piece of legislation as distinct from the legislation that's going through the Hate Crime Act. Now, I don't know if I'm utterly convinced about that. The other aspect of it is that the bedfellows that people are leaping into with, such as the Free Speech Union, I mean, and the Free Speech Union is Toby Young, Alison Pearson, Julia Hartley Brewer, and Douglas, won't anybody think about the poor Nazis committing genocide, Murray? And they're the stalwarts of the Free Speech Union. And the Free Speech Union, Leslie, seems to me to be dedicated entirely to tackling these culture war issues. But in the case of people like Douglas Murray and others, they can actually engage in hate speech, as far as I'm concerned, but whole swathes of other groups. And that's perfectly acceptable. And they will be the kind of people who complain about protests, pro-Palestinian protests, for example, on university campuses. They will be that kind of person. So again, it's one of these culture wars aspects of it. And I do go back to it, is that Andrew Tickell and Joanna Cherry are both extremely reasonable people. But it's the unreasonableness and the childishness that goes out with that. And the point that Joanna made, I think, was absolutely excellent, was some of the training material that's been revealed by Freedom of Information that's come out to train Police Scotland officers is juvenile. And I can always imagine people saying, we're going to put Joe in here. We all know who we're referring to here. And Joe's going to be there. And you're thinking, grow up. Because that just creates that atmosphere of the fact that it gives credence to the perspective. It may be used frivolously, and it may be used to tackle people who hold legitimate gender critical perspectives from an alternative feminist perspective.
Yeah, and I suppose this is reminding me of when I was on the Scottish Prisons Commission in 2008, and one discovery that it really stuck in my mind at one prison that we visited. One of the prison governors said that the problem we're having in Scotland, and actually the UK, but since we're here, is that we're criminalising nuisance behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was trying to make it a decision. You know, he was basically saying our prisons are getting clogged up with people that are pain in the arse, actually. But to be honest, he wouldn't see them as having done anything criminal. What they've generally done is they've done something nuisancey. They've had an ASBO or the equivalent. They've then breached the ASBO, and that becomes a criminal offence, the breach. So then you end up with a criminal record, then you're pulled into the whole, you know, and then we end up where we are now with prisons that are just full of people on remand even. You know, they haven't actually even, they're not even guilty of anything yet. Mm-hmm. They haven't even tried. So just coming back to this and that example you gave of, you know, the campus and somebody, you know, in a university campus and somebody, a march that's kind of essentially pro a ceasefire and has many people supporting, medical aid for Palestine.
Yeah.
If you then get a whole lot of people from the other side saying this is an anti-Semitic hate crime, which we've had, you know, quite a lot of, I mean, who would want to be the police having to stand in the middle of that and be the ones in the first instance? I don't know if it is them in the first instance, but I think it is, who would have to try to decide whether or not to investigate this as a possible crime.
Yeah.
So I mean, going to be, because this is, this is not criminal stuff to be saying something that is contestable.
Yeah.
And that's going to be the theme of this entire podcast, actually, because we're doubtless going to move on at some point to the rammy around Professor Mark Blyth, the sweary professor who spoke at Scotonomics and is now the subject of, you know, everybody basically having big run-ins about what he really meant, what he really said and so on. I'm kind of driving the car, and that's up to you.
We are going to get on to Mark Blyth, and somebody said he shoots from the lip, but he's a Dundonian, so I go with that. But again, get back to the hate crime act, though, just as a final version, it was passed by 82 votes to 32. So point the finger at the SNP. No, this was passed by everybody. I think there are a couple of abstentions, but it was passed fundamentally by the whole parliament. It was the Conservatives who stood out against it. And Hamza Yousaf, I've got a quote from him in the last debate, who said, to those who think they may accidentally somehow fall foul of the law because they believe sex is immutable, or they believe an adult man cannot become a female, or they campaign for the rights of Palestinians, or those that proselytise that same-sex relationships are sinful, none of these people would fall foul of the stirring up of hatred offence for solely stating their belief, even if they did so in a robust manner. Why? Because solely stating any belief, which I accept may be offensive to some, is not breaching the criminal threshold. And the point that Andrew Tickell made, I think, is that people should understand what the Act is about, and that goes back to the Scottish Government. They should be proselytising what the Act actually says, not what people are claiming it says on social media. And rather than trying to convince your social media enemies to report you on come April the 1st, you should be saying what the Act actually is. It's none of our interest for this prophecy to become true. So I just hope that reasonable people can hold sway here, and it will not be utilised as a way to divide us even more when we've got these significant issues that are coming about. But the reporting, yeah, we'll move on to Mark Blyth. I think we've got other things to go because we will be. But the Scotonomics Festival, which I didn't manage to make, and you chaired a couple of sessions, it was an article in The Spectator, wasn't it, Leslie? And then it was then repeated in the Daily Express, pointing out that Professor Mark Blyth, who had previously been on a commission, an economics commission, structured and organised by the Scottish government, was now turning his face on Scottish independence and saying Scotland couldn't possibly become independent because of economic reasons. It was a bit more than that, wasn't it?
Well, it was quite a lot more than that.
Yes.
I mean, the bit that the Spectator and then the Herald, you know, there's quite a lot of stuff behind paywalls, so you can only see the headlines. But pretty much everyone went, yeah, dancer, and kind of most of the unionist press picked this up. But the interview, which was pre-recorded because Mark's in the States, so it was shown at the event as a film. But, you know, he repeated what I think, as you pointed out, he said to us.
Yeah.
I mean, we had a special podcast with him last year. And he said, if the UK has been together for over 300 years, so if pulling apart 30 years of economic integration with Europe hurts, 300 is going to hurt a lot more. And so this was his view. He also sort of says you can't really say Brexit's the worst thing ever and then commit the biggest Brexit of all time, which literally is what this is. So there's quite, and I think the more to the point, he was talking about, you know, his view is as a small open economy, yeah, which you would then be as an independent country, you need to balance your imports and exports over the long term, or everyone will think your currency is shite. And at that point, they dump it, prefer payments in British pounds. Then you get a run on your foreign exchange, and then you get a mini Argentina on your hands. So just because you're independent, you can print bits of money, it doesn't mean anything if you don't have something to back it up. Now, that was kind of probably the core, you know, point of it. And obviously, the folk who organise Scotonomics are big fans of MMT, which is modern monetary theory, which posits that countries that are in control of their own currency don't have to worry about budget constraints, basically, as long as they keep inflation under control. And he was arguing with this and saying, well, that's all fine. But, you know, when you are, he thinks that can only apply to something as big as the United States, which is almost
solely
a closed
applied
economy.
To the United States, yeah.
Yeah, which is so large that it's basically a closed economy. But he thinks everybody else really has to, you know, try to vaguely make the books balance. But his and the thing was, as the interview was going on, Mark, who is I think a delightfully shooting from the lip, sweary,
oh, yeah,
you know, sort of very easy to understand guy, because he does call a spade a bloody spade. You know, the more that he was kind of being challenged on stuff, the more, if you like, emphatic he was getting. So by the end of it, he was, you know, it was words of one syllable, really. And I thought the strongest point he made, though, which really stayed with me, was, you know, he's saying, if you're an independent country, what do you actually own? What do you control?
Yes.
And this was something I brought up in a subsequent, in fact, the final session of it all, which was, I mean, he's absolutely right that you can point to the extraordinary resources, the renewable resources that Scotland has, but they are almost all owned by foreign companies and asset managers, and they don't belong to us.
No.
So we would have to do some thinking about how we manage to, you know, all that happens is our key assets are owned by not anything based in Scotland, to be blunt. And we become an independent country trying to do with energy will be our biggest asset. If we don't have any control over that, then that makes life extremely tough. Now, the thing that I don't think anybody from obviously the unionist side of it got into was the other side of what he was really saying, which is, you know, this is a product of the current situation.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Which is, you know, which is that we have been allowed to drift into Scotland, as he said at one point, essentially not having an economy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at one point he was being asked to think of a sort of independent Scottish economy, and he was saying, well, you'd need to have an economy now. I mean, he was, as I say, getting more and more to the point as time went on. But he was saying, what do you produce? What do you own, produce, and, you know, what's your stuff? He said, you're going to say whiskey. It's owned by, and he reeled off the, you know, foreign mm-hmm. companies that own that. And I think this is really to the point, because it's true both ways. That's where we've got to under the UK. Yeah. You know, we've drifted into this situation where everything essentially is owned elsewhere. That's, I think, why so many people are very keen to see, were very keen to see the thing that didn't happen, which was even the Scottish, you know, energy company that would start to make some difference in that. But I mean, that's a big issue for us, because when we become independent, what are we doing about energy? Are we renationalizing it? Are we doing what Labour are suggesting they'll do, which is just set up another production company, which will just join the ranks and, you know, own a few more assets, but essentially the big ones will already have been built? You know, these are really good big questions to be asking. Are we just going to really try to retrieve the situation by knowing that whatever tax income comes from those foreign owned companies, we can, you know, it'll be coming to us, not to anybody else, and we'll just keep our fingers crossed they didn't bugger off? I mean, just to kind of have a slight sideways think, obviously in the news as well is China at the moment, you know, kind of becoming mm-hmm. public enemy conveniently number one yeah. with cyber attacks and everything. This did, you know, we're going to hear more about that today, but the suggestion is there's going to be almost a sort of clampdown on all Chinese association or investment in projects in Britain, which just suddenly brought the word Sizewell C back yep. to mind in my head, because the Chinese were partner investors with the French EDF in Sizewell C, which is part of England's big answer to, you know, energy security. Last year, or 2022, because, you know, Chinese were beginning to look a bit dodgy, the British government decided they would have to. It was embarrassing and, you know, security and blah, blah, blah. So they decided they would buy out, spent 100 million quid buying out the kind of state-owned company of China that had made the investment in Sizewell C. And I mean, at the time of Googling, and I could be wrong, they haven't managed to find another backer for that missing 100 mm-hmm. million quid. The most likely backers are probably going to be somewhere in the Far East and very possibly the United Arab Emirates, which right. with a different hat on, this is, you know, there's a sovereign wealth fund run by the guy who owns Manchester City, who I think was also involved in the bid for the Daily Telegraph and indeed the Spectator magazine, yep. which of course caused such flurry amongst the Conservatives. But you can have mm-hmm. you can have the UAE as partners in your nuclear energy business, but you can't have them owning the Tory graph or, you know, other. But I mean, just ridiculous yeah. situation. But that's where we are with all of this stuff. You know, Britain is just basically allowing anybody with money to come in, do whatever they want, buy whatever they want, and then just has to kind of deal with the kind of ebbs and flows that result of that, and added to which, you know, has no particular economic strategy to prosecute other than low taxes as a kind of banner yes. headline. And if we're going to get out of that, we're going to have to really go some and come up with some much better thinking on this than I've heard from anybody so far.
Yeah, precisely what I was thinking, because people may not like from the modern monetary theory, because modern monetary theory comes in there and says that if you've got a fiduciary currency, what you can do is, as you say, you can print money, you can spend your life as long as you keep inflation down. But what Mark does, he asks genuine questions and reflects the way the world is now, not the way I would like the world to be. You know, that's the key point he makes. And I mean, I may have cavilled at the fact he says if it were up to him, he says this is going to be very unpopular, he would retain the nuclear base and charge $2 billion a year. You know, and that you pay off. But he also talks about that thing about you can't just walk away. You can't just walk away from the debt that the UK has accumulated, because what that will do will undermine the value of the bonds that you will issue. What he did come up with, I thought was an interesting concept, was the fact that Scotland, and this is what I liked, Scotland could come up with a bond system that we could actually test the market to see what a Scottish bond mm-hmm. against gilts would be like. But I would like to see more of the Mark Bly thinking. in terms of that's the critique mark. What do we do now? And again, in that kind of interview, it's not going to happen. And I look forward to it because this is a man who does support Scottish independence, who is vehemently opposed to the austerity policies that were introduced in the 80s and what happened after the bank crash, and comes up with incredibly insightful analysis of what happened and the impact that that has on communities. So this is a guy that ought to be listened to. And ought to be listened to seriously, and the sort of person we ought to be bringing in to have genuine, oh God, I'm going to say it again, adult discussions about what the reality would be when becoming independent, not what we would like it to be, which is a clean break and everything's fine.
Yeah, although, I mean, I notice on Twitter, he's obviously got well hacked off by being in the middle of all this, you know, everyone claiming him, you know, for one side or the other. And he said, I'm just looking at the timeline on it because he's in the States. But anyway, 15 hours ago, and it's 12 o'clock midday here. This is why I'm done talking about Scotland. It's toxic. No one wants any actual discussion of options. You say X, they say you said Y, and then spend time writing corrections. Life's too short. Done.
Yeah.
But of course, it being Mark, he couldn't resist coming in a little bit later to point out that a very interesting point, just apropos of what you were saying there about that, you know, everyone's taking this as being utter pelters towards an independent Scotland. But essentially, I think his main point is just the utter catastrophe that is Britain.
Yes.
From which, you know, if you've basically got a boat that is all but capsizing, launching the dinghy is going to be hard. You know, that's not me putting that on him. That's me thinking that this is true. Right. Mm-hmm. But he tweeted just 3 hours ago. So I don't know if he's up in the middle of the night now. But anyway, hi, Mark, if you're listening. To take one example, the average UK worker is £14,000 a year worse off now than they would have been if wages had stayed on the pre-2008 trend. Mm-hmm. So that's how much people have lost under Conservative rule, £14,000 a year. He says, this is not an accident. It is a direct result of Tory policy. They were in charge for the whole period. So you've got to take this whole thing in a round here. I mean, Britain and, you know, many things that I've been dealing with lately just keep sort of, you know, just the amount of kind of basically crap there is around when it comes. Well, let's look another thing. There was a piece, was it now ITN News or something yesterday, that just brought up some incredible statistics from the Resolution Foundation about housing. And it basically, they say the UK spends more on housing than any other developed country and gets the least value from it. Hmm. There's lots of different ways of expressing that. But basically, housing in the UK costs almost 50% more than it should do based on the relative cost of other goods. When you look at even Ireland, right, Ireland's melting down at the moment.
Yeah.
Over the housing issue. So they've got a bit, it's a bit hard to express it, but they've got 40% more than it should be if you took a baseline of the European average. So you pay 40% more if you're in Ireland. You pay 49% more if you're in the UK. There is no one above us.
Yeah.
That's how bad this is. There was another way of expressing it on the news, and it was very well explained. It was Channel 4, actually, last night. And they were basically saying that currently people are spending about 87% of their income on a mortgage. The number of people who are in that position paying that high a percentage about 10 years ago was, you know, very low. It's now something like 80%. So, you know, it's quite shocking when you get these statistics. They're also, Britain has the oldest housing stock in Europe. Percentage of housing built before the war, and okay, this is as of 2011, but I don't think we've had a tremendous building surge since then. So this is the percentage of basically pre-war housing stock, 38% in the UK, highest in Europe.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's just an awful lot of, you know, Brits 50% more likely to spend more than 2 hours commuting than EU citizens. You just want to kind of look down this incredible list of comparators. And this is what happens. This is why nobody wants you to make any comparisons with Europe or any other countries, because, you know, the second you take your head out of the kind of British bubble and the sort of, you know, going round in circles nonsense that passes for politics here, with, I mean, you know, I now begin to wonder about most stories, like even, you know, the Chinese kind of intercepting. It's just there's so much naked deflection going on that we can't spend any time looking at the big, you know, the big central issues. And I think all of that gets swept up into much of what Mark Blyth feels about where Britain is. It both increases the urgency with which you would want to quit that whole outlook. And we've spent much time talking about Keir Starmer's inability and unwillingness to deviate strongly from it. So, you know, it gives a strong will to want to do that. And at the same time, it makes it difficult to launch the dinghy. It's choppy waters, you know. Yeah. So, but still, you want to hear much more. I want to hear much more detail about what you would be doing, where you're aiming for in that choppy waters. You know, what, for particularly on energy, what's the policy for after independence? We need to have lots of people talking over the wall. You know, just talking, and it's not just I know there was the paper about education and so on.
Yeah.
Which I'm sorry, I actually couldn't. I didn't read. I've got to be really honest.
That's all right.
I did.
I know. I keep thinking
we're like one brain between us. So sometimes when I know you've read something, I think, gosh, I'm so busy, I'm just going to let you do that one.
Yeah.
So what was in that then?
Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, what was in that? Sorry, I'm shuffling around because I thought I'd got a link there to talk about housing. But I mean,
go for it. Yes, because you wanted to talk about housing for ages.
Yeah. Well, it was the aspect of it. It was based upon the fact of the Stephen Flynn zinger, which most people would have, who listened to the podcast, would have seen by now, talking about the Thatcher loving that you wrote the article about, Leslie. We'll talk about the points that you made. But one of the key aspects of it was, and Labour has decided, unlike in Wales, which is under a Labour government with Plaid Cymru support, and in Scotland, where the right to bind has been eliminated. And what this does is that there were 6.5 million council houses that are now down to 2.2 million. Two-thirds of British council homes were privatised. And one of the things I didn't think about was that one of the major aspects of this, that councils in England are no longer building council houses. Why? Because the minute they build these excellent council houses, they're sold off.
Yeah.
And they're facing insolvency, partly based upon the fact we're not building council houses, so we've got more people in homeless accommodation. We're having to shell out for all this. And it's that vicious circle based around this whole fact of the privatisation that took place. And mega numbers of them now, I think it was over 40% of the homes that were actually sold off under right to buy in England are now privately rented. And the rents that people are paying are substantially more than they would have been paying in council houses. So University College London says right to buy remains the major disincentive to local authorities building more social homes, because they rightly fear the policy will impact any new housing developments they undertake. So build excellent council houses, wait a couple of years, paint's barely dry, and people come in and buy them. And then within some time period, they're now being privately rented out. So it's part of that whole thing of the Thatcher inheritance that you discussed in your article. And there's a lot more to it, the Thatcher inheritance. And it's the mythology that's been built up around her about this. She was transformative. She was visionary, but my God, there's a lot of visionaries out there that you're turning and say, well, hang on a minute, you wouldn't want to fly the flag for them. But the mythology around Thatcher and the transformation she allegedly took place, and what has now become acceptable and unchallenged, and in the way she shifted society and income in this country, it was absolutely appalling. And most people, many young people, have no idea of what actually happened. But over to you, Ms. Riddick, because of the article in The National.
Yeah, which was really, I mean, just, you know, picking up still on your thing about housing, I'm just noticing it's a small point, but in today's news applying to England, 300 councils in England are calling for the UK government to keep its promise to ban no-fault evictions. And that's actually a leading story in The Sun now, which is kind of, you know, these are not bleeding hearts, these guys. They've also got a renters reform bill that Gove brought in. Apparently, this is in danger of being neutered like his attempts to reform leasehold in England, which is a sort of tenure that is extremely problematic and doesn't exist so much, I think, at all north of the border. But I mean, so this is kind of, this is what was put together as the minimum of what would begin to change the situation for people renting in England. And it's just completely gone pear-shaped. You know, it, none of it ever happens. So anyway, and that is Thatcher's legacy. I mean, somebody got in touch, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name now, to point out that one of the long list of privatisations that I had in the article, where I was asking, does anybody think that any of these privatisations were successful? And I'm assuming that we can just rule out, you know, shareholders going, well, it worked for me, honey, right?
Yes. But
for the sort of public good, did any of them work at all? And he pointed out it was actually John Major in 1993 that did the rail privatisation. But in a way, that's the other point, is that this is like a virus that just actually is now in the body politic, so that it was pretty uncontroversial, actually, to flog off rail. Another very interesting point at the Scottonomics thing was made by actually a BBC economics correspondent who was saying that, you know, we all forget that actually Gordon Brown had a whole stack of proposed privatisations when he when Labour came in. And that's the degree, of course, Thatcher famously said that her legacy was Tony Blair. And, you know, you look back at it and just think that's a kind of, you know, that's just a sort of, well, that's just her mixing it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
You think. But actually, this is the difficulty, that it shifted. So we got all this, you know, private finance initiatives to do capital building projects. We got the best value in an initiative, which meant that councils felt legally obliged to take the lowest bid for any off any service they were had up for procurement, which is only now being reversed with this community wealth building, so that basically contracts for stuff that could have been keeping local people employed had to go, in their minds, to, you know, a multinational that was going to give it for tuppence halfpenny and keep everyone on 0 hour contracts. Thanks, Maggie. But all of that came from that outlook, that seismic change, and you needed to be alive before it.
Yes.
To understand just how seismic it was. So that, you know, obviously there's the long list of crap privatizations. But it's also kind of almost the mood, you know, that in all of this I was relating, and a couple of people got in touch. I cannot find the name of the blooming documentary, actually, about the Specials. And I know you're a big Specials fan as well. But that song, Ghost Town, I mean, just if you like it, then you like it. You know, the late, great Terry Hall on vocals there. But it just encapsulates something. And to me, it was kind of almost the loss of innocence of the previous decade. And in my instance, decades plural, perhaps for yours. I'm not trying to be funny. But it just was like the tin lid, you know, because it was like everything was going wrong. People were, all your friends were being laid off. You were just seeing a wreckage around you, basically. Anger amongst people, you know, that great line in Ghost Town, you know, the dance halls are closing because the kids are fighting with each other. And that just the collapse of everything people had previously expected. I can remember being the last person at the BBC, where I joined as a trainee in 19 something or other, 86. I was the last person to have a pension. Now, you know, we're going full, because after that, everybody was given the option to opt out. And of course, everybody goes, yeah, let's just have the money.
Keep the money now, yeah.
And then, you know, you get to the other end, the employer doesn't need to contribute. So you're not just losing the bit you put in, you're losing their bit. And then when you get, you know, a bit older, you go, oh my God, I've got nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that came from Thatcher, and for anybody in the Labour Party, to David Lammy to describe Thatcher as a visionary. I mean, if you weren't already disillusioned enough with David Lammy for his comments on Gaza, this is, I mean, as I said, this would be laughable if it wasn't so dangerous, because Thatcher was a political thug. That's what she was. And there's no getting away with it. I don't know what Rachel Reeves could even be referring to when she talks about Thatcher deserving praise for delivering supply-side reforms and rejecting Britain's managed decline. I mean, by whom then? Is that so you're saying a previous Labour government were just managing decline? That is what you're saying. And your supply-side reforms, I mean, what is that other than privatisation? Or, I don't know, maybe you mean actually clobbering the trade unions and feeding into that myth that overpowerful trade unions had brought Britain to a standstill. Look at the most powerful and successful countries around us, and they have far greater percentages of union membership. Just because I'm on Denmark at the moment, I have those statistics in my head. Mm-hmm. 67% of workers in Denmark are members of trade unions. Norway, always in my head somehow. Scotland has about 29%, so that's 67% Denmark, 29%-ish Scotland. In absolute numbers, we have 500,000 trade unionists. Norway, same population, 2 million. So that everywhere else operates on the basis that it has an agreed template that was agreed in the 1930s to stop all this us versus them in everything, from government, which is where proportional representation came in, to particularly the industrial arena. After very destructive general strikes, they went, okay, so we don't really want to do this again, and absolutely developed collective bargaining and all sorts of embeddedness of trade unions in the working of companies and businesses and state operations. So there's no way you could sort of have this trade unions of the evil empire, because they are the people, and they're the reason that everything works, and that's normal. So where we've got to here, and you just can't say this enough, is an utterly abnormal situation of terrible decline, which you can't burst through by just trying to kind of, you know, tweak corners or try to kind of think there's some little tiny corner of Thatcher that you could kind of think is roughly okay. This is just bullshit and an irreversible mistake. I honestly had my jaw on the ground with this. I'm almost speechless. I can see, you can see what the Labour's doing, but to actually cross that Rubicon and lie, these are lies about Thatcher. She was terrible. There is no two ways about it.
Yeah, and I put up the link to the YouTube interview that Mark Blythe did on Scottonomics, where he talks about the intentions behind it. But supply side, fundamentally, what it was based around was the whole concept that too much money chasing too few goods. So you bump up interest rates and you cut tax rates for the very wealthy, and you squeeze the economy. And it led to millions of people being out of work. The one in 10, remember, from UB40. I mean, but I took it, when I did, when I looked at the article, I thought, I'm going to go back and just check. Because I remember when I was teaching, I did a whole case study in, it was to do with advertising and the way Baxter Soups, believe it or not, decided to restructure the promotion and advertising based upon the economic changes that had taken place in the UK under Margaret Thatcher, because they were trying to target a specific demographic, because it was a massive shift in income to the southeast of England, and there was a massive shift in terms of the spending power. Because when Thatcher came into power, 83% was the top rate of tax. It dropped to 40%. So it was double the rate when Thatcher came to power. And this doubling goes right through this, Leslie. Value-added tax, an incredibly regressive tax, because the less you earn, the more you pay. What she did specifically was cut tax rates for the wealthy and doubled VAT almost from 8% to 15%, you know, and then went up to 17.5%, as you say, because John Major just continued it. It went up to 17.5% under John Major, I think the year after he became Prime Minister. And during that time, the post-tax income gap between the top 10% and the bottom 10% of the population doubled in 18 years. And child poverty more than doubled. So that's your vision, Labour, and that's the Iron Lady, and that's what she stood for and did. And what happened as well is, if it was meant to tackle the industrial decline and what was going on in the UK, it did not work. Productivity low, output low, and a lot of people got a lot of money out of investing in hedge funds and in banking, and that all came crashing down in the banking crash. That's Thatcher's legacy.
Yeah.
And the kids I worked with in the 1980s who couldn't get bloody work. That's the Thatcher legacy.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of presumption almost that, yeah, that we didn't need a manufacturing base because we could just, you know, buy stuff in from elsewhere. Yep. All the stuff, it was kind of claggy, you know, could we not have things that were just nice, cleaner jobs and, you know, making things was a bit last season, really. And then you kind of jump along to all her prejudices. You know, she didn't like public transport. So then she deregulated the buses, knackered pretty much the bus, you know, whole areas listening to this have now got knackered bus services. This isn't to say they wouldn't have faced problems, you know, without her. But by gum, actually, now we've got to a stage where there's kind of renationalization on the cards, which has taken a very long time because we've got, you know, everybody knows the story of what's happened with the buses running empty deliberately to put competitors out of business.
Then
on the rail front, the Tories have now had to renationalize Trans-Pennine Express, which might be, you know, to many people here, you might think, so what? But actually, that is the fourth failed English franchise that's had to be taken into public ownership in as many years by the government that introduced privatisation. And yet, you know, it's extraordinary. Is that a supply side reform? Or maybe that's a, you know, to quote Keir Starmer, that's an example of Thatcher, quote, setting loose Britain's natural entrepreneurialism.
Yeah.
Anyway, we could go on and on. Let's stop. I mean, she's just, God damn it, no.
No. Well, I mean, thinking of the child poverty, which does actually, believe it or not, lead us into the reading I did on the Building a New Scotland, the education paper. Child poverty was right at the top of the priorities to be that could be tackled in independent Scotland, because everybody's aware education is actually a devolved function. So it was an interesting paper to read in that sense, because what I kept looking for is what the Scottish Government could do now in terms of education. And coming from an FE background, very little from that framework. And the other aspect of it was they were talking about the fact of the extension of the ability of parents to delay entry to primary one, and that being funded through the Scottish Government, and that's going to come into force, I believe. So which is a good move, which is, fundamentally we're turning around saying you don't start school till you're six because we're going to fund your nursery education. But what it did when I read it was that right at the roots, it's that thing that you've talked about extensively in the past, Liz, is that link between child poverty and poverty in general and lack of educational attainment. So, and it says that these are the things that the Scottish Government in the future can tackle. They talked about scrapping the rate clause, the two-child limit, increasing family incomes, lifting families out of poverty, removing the benefit cap, replacing universal credit budgeting loans, ending the current benefit sanctions regime. So these are all things that the government can do. And I found that was a very interesting emphasis that was going to be based on it. There are the things that go around, but I would see that we're going to extend the right to vote 16 to 17 year olds paid lady after miscarriage, and embed the rights of the child, which, remember, of course, the UK government stopped us doing up here because it was, for a variety of reasons, this was not going to be permitted. So again, the thing I took out of it was very little other than that element to do with early years education on what the Scottish Government could do now, but a lot of a praise for itself of what it was doing in terms of mitigating the effects of UK government policies. But talk about the ability, having the economic levers to tackle child poverty and to tackle poverty, and in so doing, tackle the root causes of the education gap. So it was interesting enough. Again, is it going to set the heather on fire? I don't really think so, because the key aspect of it is education policy is currently devolved, and they can't come out and announce any major change without maybe saying that it isn't actually working the way it ought to now.
Yeah, well, but there is that, isn't there? You know, with all the stories about kind of behaviour in class and, teachers not, you know, finishing their training because and it's hard to know quite how widespread a lot of these problems are. And actually, this is another point. You know, every time you talk about a difficulty, you're quite kind of aware that, OK, elsewhere in the UK, there is a bigger problem, pretty much, in almost everything. And of course, that doesn't sort of mean, well, that's great, we can just skip out because we've got less of a bad problem than anywhere else. But it does suggest that the sort of, it does demonstrate the grip that, but that not being, coming back to the questions of the economy, not being able to decide to essentially find the money tree and sort some way out as an independent country, mm-hmm. invest basically in services and in improvements. We can't do that. So you're basically just still slightly passing the parcel around. But I've got to say, you know, Jenny Gilruth, the education secretary, was at the screening of the Denmark film mm-hmm. in Holyrood. And I mean, it suggests, you know, you're still looking. This is independence, post-independence. So you can actually, you know, come on, you can go some here, right? And it's fine to have, you know, a pledge to expand childcare provision. This needs to be just put in, and it needs to be explained that, you know, all the evidence suggests that when kids are from 3 till 6 in a kind of really well supported environment where they're, you know, I'm just repeating this, everyone yeah. listening to this could do the rest of the script themselves. The levels of cooperation begin to absolutely rise from that early years experience. I mean, just to sort of, I realise this is just a summary of the paper, a pledge to expand childcare provision. Okay, if I'm a parent or a grandparent or anybody close to parents, you can kind of flesh that out for yourself. But come on, you need to actually say this is, because what happens is you get this done, this paper produced, and then everybody who's now thinking, God, you know, it's going to hell on a handcart in lots of schools and behaviour's appalling. How do you manage to create a more cooperative environment yeah. in schools? Well, this is how you do it. And you've got to unravel that and not just keep having technocratic, you know, stuff that just people go, oh, God, do you realise that we can actually get the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child fully incorporated into Scottish law if we become independent? I mean, nobody's going to say that. You need to turn that into, and forgive me if it's actually all there and I didn't read it, I'm just reading the summary. mm-hmm. You know, you've got to kind of flesh out what that means in educational terms. So, I mean, in Denmark, all they're trying to do is keep creating situations where kids can learn to take on responsibility and cooperate and discover more about themselves. Hence their extraordinary year at the age of 15, where kids can go away from home and spend a year learning to dive, as well as doing their academic studies with a yeah. whole squad of other 15-year-olds from around Denmark. Jaw-dropping, but funded partly by parents, but mostly by the state, because it's part of a citizenship project, which is what people who did not have their arms up their backs told us, because they understand the larger point of it all. Yeah. So all of these sort of like tick box things, you get this, you get that, it's like a lucky bag of stuff. But where's the wrapper? You know, where's the kind of concept of how education as a whole would change? It just needs a lot more. It just needs a lot more to say we're educating kids to be active citizens in their own country, not just fodder for, you know, for their first business experience.
Yes.
And in that respect, we are wholesale and consciously dipping across the North Sea to take up the best aspects of education from yeah. Denmark and Finland.
Yeah. Where the sense of society and social solidarity is embedded. And it's back to Thatcher again, who promulgated that whole ideology which has been carried forward. There are individuals and families. There is no such thing as society.
But the thing is, this is true. But, you know, what other countries are doing is they're not just having an abstract war of words about stuff. You know, you could have a government raining down stuff about the importance of the individual. If you're actually one of the 15-year-olds who's away from home for the first time in their lives, discovering, you know, living together, cooking together, taking care of one yeah. another, and actually learning the opposite. Motor memory is a far, far better
Absolutely.
Thing than yep. any abstract debate. And what we're ending up having are lots of bloody abstract debates about stuff. Thatcher did also not do abstractions. She put her money where her mouth was, which was entirely, you know, also Mark Blythe's yes. point. There was the propaganda of the whole thinking, and by gum, did she ever put the wrapper on stuff and, you know, kind of created a whole judgment about the undeserving poor and all the sort of tropes that we're still dealing with. Absolutely, those were flying, but they were hanging on to actual concrete moves that she made. So we need to have moves, you know, and changes and something tangible for people to see and cotton on to.
Right. I've just picked up on the word debate following people. Again, our collective memories are not so short as the debacle that took place in Westminster over the Speaker Lindsay Hoyle's decision to bring forward the Labour amendment, which was on a humanitarian ceasefire, and that passed without anyone noticing. And I noticed, and you retweeted this with a robust reply to that well-known Labour loyalist, John McDermott, who seemed to be suggesting that it was the UK Labour Party, through its amendment being accepted in Westminster, which had fundamentally led to the fact of changing UK foreign policy, which obviously had impacted US foreign policy, which had then led to the United Nations passing a call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. And yes, John, you put it so perfectly, Leslie. Oh God, I'm blowing smoke up your backside there. No, you put it so really well. I'm going to let you come back on that one about the retort to Mr. McTernan.
Well, you know, the big reality actually is a big thing happened, in that the United States, as everyone will know now, abstained in United Nations Security Council resolution demanding the immediate ceasefire and the immediate return of the hostages. And let's not, you know, there's two clear points on that. So that's great. The only abstention was the United States. So the UK, I think, voted in favour this time, mm-hmm. because of that change in direction that they hadn't really, you know, said very explicitly they were acknowledging. Today, John McTernan basically just tweeted that the numbers from the United Nations and commented, Labour's ceasefire motion changed UK foreign policy. Right. I mean, that is so cynical, even for John. And it's typical that he knows that is so bitterly contested that he's almost going to the heart of something that any number of people now know is completely misrepresenting the whole situation. But I did ask him back, logically, if Labour had backed Humza Yousaf's ceasefire call in November, UK foreign policy would have shifted then, and thousands in Gaza might have survived the last 4 months. Haven't seen a reply from him on that. But this is just rubbish. You know, and of course, people are kind of coming back and saying, well, just this is all still semantics and whatever. Just watch, you know, the whole purpose of a world community and the slow application of pressure onto Joe Biden. That would have been quicker had everybody started to see that this would be mm-hmm. the end point we'd always end. I mean, every normal freaking person could see that we would end up having to have a ceasefire call, and that all now, strangely enough, all the semantics about temporary pauses and ceasefires not being meaningful, funny, that's all burned away, right? That could have gone in October of last year when all of this started, and I think Humza Yousaf's first statement came. We could have saved, potentially, if we do save anyone now, if this change means anything, if heat is now applied, you know, to Netanyahu, and there's been some very interesting analyses, you know, suggesting that he is now, his government is imploding, basically, because most of the characters in his cabinet are taking different tacks on almost everything and are scattered across the globe, actually having conversations that they look mm-hmm. pretty freelancing, and perhaps suggesting that they might be the successor to Netanyahu, when in fact, the polls in Israel suggest that his party would be just completely out if they had any chance, any say in the matter. Well, of course, this is a thing. It's like people talk about, you know, getting a tanker to turn at sea. The first turn is infinitely small. But if it isn't made, the second doesn't happen. And with a tanker, the sooner you start those small bits of pressure that create change, of course, you know, it's going to take time. That's why you have to be bold and early. So, you know, to just play politics with
absolutely.
This, when all of us can visualize, you know, that.
Yes, it is the epitome, I think, of the modern Labour Party in terms of its use of incredibly painful situations and the ability of the cynical, as you say. I'm all in favour of scepticism, but the cynicism of UK politics to see everything in those terms of political advantage and how can I strike a blow and how can I do this and I get under. And I mean, it is the whole thing that goes on in terms of the politicisation of situations where you get every decision that's being made being and accusations flying around. And it is the what McTiernan suggested there, but just absolutely epitomised what's wrong with the UK Labour Party and its current iteration. And I don't think it's going to change at all. And we've managed successfully, I think, to navigate our way around to, and I do make a promise that at some point I will be talking about land reform, but I think I'll leave that to another day because I think we've come to a rather natural conclusion and I need to get back to tidying the house and before Mrs. Joyce gets in, because she will come in and walk in to the area I'm sitting in here and go, look at this. So I'm going to try and get in the good books.
I just say, as a sort of, you know, independent observer of your situation, your house is immaculate, honestly. I mean, don't comment. This place is like a bomb site compared to yours. But anyway, I appreciate everyone has their different standards. Actually, the other thing we should mention, though, is the WASPI kind of business.
Yes.
Just before we disappear with that.
Yeah.
Because that does seem to, you know, it's another of these ones that, you know, people... The perception of it is that women are complaining because they weren't given notice about an equalisation of the age at which you receive your pension. When at the base of that, I mean, I saw an argument on The National today by Shona Craven that kind of, you know, if there was equalisation of pensions, that's kind of who can complain about that. So, I mean, that's beginning to be the trope that's allowing this to basically fall off the edge. You need to kind of look at what was being said at the time. The rate of these changes was quite unbelievable. In 2011, actually, without any warning, all the changes that were being predicted were brought in immediately, practically, before the legislation had even kicked in, practically, to get this to happen. But let's listen for a minute to what was said by people involved at the time. Former Pensions Minister Steve Webb, this is a Tory, right, later said, basically, we made a bad decision. We realised too late. It had just gone too far by then. Chancellor George Osborne, who was, you know, involved in all of this, this was basically looking for a way to find £30 billion worth of savings. And he said in a global investment conference in 2013, accelerating the state pension age for women probably saved more money than anything else we did, and it was not controversial.
Mm.
And that's why, because these women born in the 50s, that's before me, are set to lose an average £45,000 or 6 years of pension. That's not nothing. And the final point to say, and this is what most of these women would like to have said, I think, having written an article about this a couple of years ago, is that this is on top of all sorts of constraints that most women have had during their working lives. So 85% of WASPI women had children, dropped out of higher education, made do with low-paid jobs instead of building up a well-paid career, missed out on state benefits, which are still generally aimed at full-time workers or single women. The state pension triple lock doesn't cover the poorest people on pension credit. Most of them are women. So it's kind of, women have lower lifetime earnings. The Fawcett Society estimated that over a lifetime, the average woman earns £300,000 less than a man. And that's, so therefore they have lower workplace pensions. So all of this sits at the back of that WASPI situation. And it doesn't look as if anybody cares enough, Labour don't, to actually make good on it, which is appalling but utterly predictable. And really, unless the women of the world, the 50s women, are going to do some really high profile striking, which of course hasn't helped the doctors or anybody else south of the border, you know, you wonder what's actually going to actually happen.
Well, Labour have, that's another vault fast from Labour, who were all in favour of supporting the WASP women, and now, oh, they've got a sniff of power. And it's the weasel words that come out again as well. But just on a personal basis, that's the generation of women, you know, that I know. It's Jill, my wife, it's her sister, it's that whole range of women. And one of the key aspects of it, Leslie, and in addition to that, is absolutely no time being given, even if you had the financial wherewithal, to actually prepare for this. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no preparation time allowed for it. It was just that there it is. And one of the things that I think was, if we were going to equalise the pension age, why didn't they lower the men's? Because the whole idea was to save money. That's what it was all about. And it didn't, the previous regime, where people say that's unfair, that did take account of the differential in terms of women working and women bringing up children and the lesser pay that they receive because of all of this. And I'm just looking at the personal experiences of the women I know. You hit the nail on the head every single time about children, about dropping out of higher education, about taking a lower paid job, taking part-time work in order to enable you to do all these other unpaid things upon which we depend in our society.
And so, upon which your pension would then be calculated to correct. Be pretty crap anyway. So, you know, that's where we are with this. But anyway, you know, just to have that said. And so we march on to another eventful week. Actually, I'm off to, there's a sold out screening of the Denmark film in Edinburgh, which is the first time it's actually got to Edinburgh. So it'll be in the Cameo, which will be interesting. And there's a screening in Kirkcaldy that I think is almost sold out the following week, which will be live streamed. So for anybody who's missing all of this and going, I wanted to hear some of these Q&As and stuff, there will be a live stream out there and more details of that soon.
Yes, and I'll pop the links into the Denmark movies. And what I've got to look forward to is going to the dentist on Thursday to discover whether it's going to be an extraction or joy of joys, root canal work.
Oh!
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, it's fun times in the Joyce household. So hopefully I will be sufficiently recovered and not reduced to a gibbering wreck next Tuesday. And on that, oh, poor wee me note, we'll see you next week, James.